Welcome to Pitch Deck, the podcast where startup founders pitch their business to investor angels or established mentors. We provide constructive feedback on both the business and the pitch itself. I'm your host, Nick Telson, and let's jump straight into the pitch studio and meet today's guests. So I'm delighted to welcome on my side of the table today, we have Melissa Lester, who is an investment partner at Dig Ventures, which is the family office of MuleSoft founder Ross Mason. Following MuleSoft's $6.5 billion acquisition by Salesforce in 2018 and 4 years of Ross himself angel investing in San Francisco, Melissa and Ross together launched Dig Ventures to formalize Ross's angel investing. They're a very small team that invests from angel until seed, with a focus on B2B SaaS companies in Europe and the US. And I was really keen to get Melissa and Dig on board because I see them as a nice bridge between venture and angel. So we're delighted to have you here today, Melissa.
Thanks, Nick. Real honour to be on the show.
Great. So before we actually dive into the pitch studio and meet today's founder, I'm just going to ask you a few questions about the investment world as you see it today. So firstly, what trends are you looking out for at Dig, you know, maybe in a post-corona world or just a normal world?
So our thesis has always been B2B SaaS. Companies starting don't always have to be selling to enterprises from the outset, but they definitely need to have a plan to get there in their first few years. And our thesis hasn't actually changed that much during the pandemic. If anything, it's accelerated the need for a number of areas that we've really started to double down on. So those being data privacy, anything around the so-called future of work, tools that allow introspection and reporting on how people and algorithms are working, and no low-code platforms are some themes that we're particularly interested in. We have been really excited more recently, so I guess, you know, since COVID, by the rise of collaboration platforms. So those that, which are helping remote teams work more productively and cost efficiently. And by collaboration, these aren't just tools like Atlassian and Zoom, which everyone knows, but also software that's actually helping automate processes, and maybe no low code platforms that are allowing people to do more on their own whilst being centrally governed. That's, I think, particularly kind of becoming more and more important.
Excellent. And you obviously see a ton of pitch decks themselves, you know, pre-corona pitches in person. What's your sort of pet hate when seeing a deck or hearing a pitch?
It has to be opaque language. And I know investors are guilty of this too. So I have to be careful what I say, but I do think founders are so well versed in their fields, and sometimes they can get carried away and excited and use language that's really well associated with their field, but not everyone's always on their level and understands it. So the preference is always to simplify communication, make it as direct as possible. And of course, the easier it is to understand a company, the quicker we can have a more meaningful conversation about things like vision and how a company's actually thinking about taking their business to market.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, at the end of the day, if a founder can't get across their company to someone who's not in the industry, then, you know, that says something about maybe their communication skills as well.
Yeah, exactly. We always said at MuleSoft, somehow after a while, we managed to turn kind of integration and connectivity into something relatively sexy to developer and exec audiences. So the same expectation applies to, I guess, new founders and companies we're speaking with.
My chairman, actually, at Design My Night, who I speak to regularly and is an investor himself, always said to me when I went into the world of angel investing, be very wary of solo founders. He actually tends to only invest in companies where there's more than one founder. What's yours and what's Dig's take on solo founder versus multiple founders?
Yeah, interesting question. So, I mean, technically, if you look at the data, despite a common misconception, solo founders are actually more successful. But there is this ingrained belief that VCs and other investors routinely choose to fund companies that are founded by teams rather than those with a solo founder. And actually, I think the data, the same data, is contrary to what most aspiring founders would guess. Speaking for myself, I love dynamics of kind of really good co-founders. And at Dig, we pride ourselves in actually being able to assess well-grounded co-founding relationships. And I guess you can't help but be influenced by your own experiences. And I will caveat this with, I have only been investing for a couple of years, but what we've seen over the last couple of years is that three or more co-founders can actually be quite a risky undertaking. Decision making can sometimes be more complicated, maybe less bold, and role delineation can sometimes also be a bit more confusing. So that's not to say that three or more don't work, but for us, certainly, there is a higher perceived risk.
So the sweet spot for you guys is two, and they've got a great dynamic.
I'd say, yeah, I'm not really giving a direct answer. I'd say solo or two. We're actually looking now at investing in three co-founders, so that there really is no rule. But if we're quantifying risk by experience, I'd say three or more is probably the higher.
Excellent. And if you're allowed to say, what's been the best performing Dig investment to date and why?
So I'll answer this on two fronts. So from Ross's angel portfolio, so kind of pre-formation of Dig Ventures, I mean, he's had fantastic exits from Lyft, Cosmify, Dubset, and more recently Headspin just became a unicorn. So his angel portfolio, though very diverse, has been really high performing. From Dig's side, we've only done a handful of investments in the UK and Europe. And I'm not one to pit my investments against each other, but if I was to shine a light on a company, it'd be an insurtech called Flock. They're actually the first insurtech to use real-time data in the drone industry to price insurance from single drone pilots all the way up to the world's largest fleets. And in the last 3 years, they've absolutely soared in dominance in the UK market. And actually, since COVID, the number of use cases for drones has rocketed, with governments using drones to transport medical goods to undertaking surveillance and security missions with the police forces. So really exciting company. They've just brought in some very high profile hires. And for any investors listening to the podcast, they'll likely probably be doing a Series A within the next year.
And I actually think I saw on LinkedIn the other day that BrewDog were experimenting doing beer delivery with drones. So thank you very much for that. Really great answers. What we're going to do now is head straight into the pitch studio and meet today's startup founder, who is Julian from a company called Seller. So welcome to Pitch Deck, Julian.
Hey, Nick. Thanks for having me.
Delighted to have you. So the floor is yours. So let's hear your pitch.
Seller is essentially a private B2B marketplace that makes it really, really, really simple for breweries to sell their beer to trade. So that's their pubs, bars, restaurants, or any other business that buys directly from the brewery. But before we delve into that, I think it'd be worth starting on some context as to where this all came from. So while I was studying, I actually founded a startup with two friends working on something entirely different. We were building a new restaurant ordering experience, and things were going pretty well. You know, we had over 10,000 users. We were backed by Techstars, by Metro, the European hospitality giant, and we had a number of great angels on board as well. And then there was one day, and I remember it well, it was the 28th of August last year, where a conversation we had that day would go on to trigger a chain of events and see us completely change direction within a matter of weeks. So we shared a co-working space with the guys from Good Things Brewing, and we were showing them some of the new functionality that we'd built on our platform when Chris, who's the founder of Good Things, sort of snatched the phone out of my hands and started asking a bunch of like really in-depth questions, you know, about what we built. He kind of looked up and he said, "What you've built could change the way breweries sell their beer." You know, I remember feeling slightly uncomfortable because what did the software that we built for restaurants have anything to do with breweries and selling their beer? And the truth is, we practically knew nothing about brewing, but there was something in Chris's sense of conviction that made us feel like there was an opportunity there, and we just didn't know what it was yet. And Chris realized that continuing with that classic brewery sales blueprint wasn't going to cut it for them. And that's when he started looking for solutions. And as a startup, when you know someone who tells you that they're willing to pay you to solve a problem, your ears sort of, you know, prick up and it grabs your attention. And it was that evening that we hacked together a super lean prototype, largely based on, you know, what we'd already built, just to test what the adoption from their end customers was going to be like and see what their reaction was, because we knew if they weren't going to adopt something like this, then it was a bit of a non-starter. And the reaction was really positive. So our next question was, okay, is Chris and Good Thing Brewing problem unique, or were there more breweries like them? And how many breweries had that same problem? And it was at this point that we put the restaurant concept on autopilot whilst we simultaneously continued to build out on this initial prototype that we had for Good Things. But then we went out to speak to as many breweries as possible, as well as just spending the remainder of our free time in the pubs and the bars to really understand the problem from their side. And finally, we, based on the conversations that we had, we believed that we were onto a real opportunity. And there was this great sort of initial niche market for breweries, but there was also this significant growth potential into adjacent markets like, you know, other craft beverage producers. And the more we learned from those conversations about how the industry in the space was currently operating and the challenges that these brewers had, the more our end vision essentially became clearer, and there was potential beyond simply being this B2B marketplace for breweries' direct trade sales. And I remember there was this one very clear point in one of our team meetings where we sort of assessed the two concepts against each other. And that was the first time we really acknowledged that we learned the difference between, you know, a vitamin and a painkiller. And it was at that point that it was actually over Christmas, at the end of 2019, that we decided to lay the restaurant concept to rest. And 2020 started perfectly for us. You know, we were closing new breweries in every meeting, and all the way up until about mid-March. We even had some additional funding committed. We moved into, you know, our new offices in London with comically bad timing. And that's when the world sort of turned on its head, and all of our plans just flew out the window. And, you know, there was this initial panic of working out whether or not there was still a business there. But ultimately, what we needed to do became way clearer. It was a case of get to ramen profitability, or it was game over for us. With some crude sort of back of the napkin calculations, that meant that we needed to get to 30 paying breweries before November, which at the time was 5 breweries a month for 6 months. From sort of late May and definitely in June, we had some like early signs of encouragement, I'd say. So this was things like, you know, some of our existing customers asking if they could start paying again, and you know, new breweries, you know, large breweries that we hadn't even approached yet were finding us and requesting access to the platform. And yeah, within the space of 1 month, we achieved 13 out of our 30 breweries from the 6 month plan. And we're hoping that this continues and we become even more stretched in over the next month, that it would be a good time to test the demand for an opportunity like Cellars, because we want to move quickly and we want to seize the opportunity that we see in front of us.
Perfect. Thank you very much for that. I'm sure Melissa and myself will have a ton of dig deeper questions, shall we say. Before we go into those, I just want to ask you a few more softly questions, which other startup founders might be in the same position as you. So one obviously very interesting point is having a company and while running that company, having an idea for a second company. How difficult was it to close the first company and do the second company? Also, how did you communicate that with your team? And also, how did you communicate that with your investors, that you're completely changing the game here in terms of what they invested in?
So I think it's a really interesting question, because you're so emotionally involved with any company that you're working on in the earliest stages, right? So it's almost difficult to distinguish between where you as a person ends and where the company sort of begins. So there's a lot of sort of emotional baggage. And I think, you know, we were excited by the opportunity that we had, but it was that moment that we had with Chris where there was this new potential opportunity. And ultimately it became clear to us while we were running them alongside each other that one, as I said, was solving a real problem. But between me and the team, it was more sort of just complete transparency. And I think I was always the one that was most skeptical. And this was the side hustle within the hustle, if that makes sense. And ultimately, the more excited we were becoming about the opportunity. And I think from the investor perspective, I think from their perspective, it was, you know, we're fortunate to have great investors. They were very encouraged by, you know, the sort of early success that we were seeing on this initial side concept.
And what do you think has been the hardest part of your journey so far as a founder?
That's another great question. The hardest part of the journey so far is finding a genuine problem that needs to be solved. So I think that was, you know, something that we almost learned the hard way. It was only when, you know, we were approached by Chris from Good Things and spoke, had those early brewery conversations that we realized, right, that's what solving a problem is really like.
So Melissa, let's bring you in now to really dig into the business itself. So if you want to kick off with some questions.
Pun intended with a dig. Great to meet you, Julian. We have a very punnable name. So thanks, Julian. Really, really great overview. I have to say I'm not a beer expert by any means. You definitely know more than I do now, but I'm very much coming at this from the kind of B2B SaaS perspective. And my first question is really around the sort of difference that you struck between delineating between a vitamin and a painkiller. I think this is obviously a really important concept and one that's even easier to qualify in the current circumstances as to what really sticks. How have you delineated between being so-called nice to have versus kind of mission critical problem? Like, has there been a way that you've sort of been able to quantify the problem to prospective customers? How do you think about that?
I think quantifying it is quite difficult, to be honest. I mean, there are obviously, when you've got both sort of further down the line and you could probably take more of a data-driven approach. But for us, it was really a case of that gut feel in those early days where, you know, we were trying to make the breweries convince us that this was a problem that couldn't be solved. And we were sort of putting, you know, competitive products in front of them. Does this solve the problem? Does this solve the problem? And I think when you have that sort of feeling of urgency and you know that they're sort of coming to you, even it's like that's a pretty clear indicator. And I think as well, when you find those early adopting customers, it's the fact that they're able to guide where the product is actually going and give you that, you know, essential input.
That's interesting. I think in Dig's experience, we've often found that early pilots can be, you know, can provide some fantastic feedback, but a really good leading indicator as to how something like this would scale would be to kind of always create the compelling events, irrespective as to whether, you know, there's already an existing problem. So I'd love kind of, maybe not for this conversation, but certainly over time to kind of understand how the team are thinking about really essentially making this more of a scalable problem for not just breweries, but as you said, adjacent markets to think about, be it cost savings or whatever they might need around their needs, above and beyond kind of just, you know, a fantastic reception. But it's great to hear that everybody you've spoken to so far is really excited.
Can I just jump in? You'd be mentioning painkillers, vitamins, etc. I don't think I got from the pitch what is the main problem that Seller is solving. Like, how did breweries order their or sell their beer before, and how is Seller revolutionizing that?
Sure. Yeah. The initial problem was very specific and clear, right? You know, first things first, Chris and Good Things had reached this point where, like, we call it a capacity ceiling in terms of the number of customers each salesperson could handle, right? You know, emails and phone calls, which is the way, you know, the ordering currently happens in the industry, is inherently inefficient and fragmented. I think at the time they had maybe, you know, 50, 60 direct customers who they were managing and ordering from direct. But if you're able to give them this platform that they can offer their customers, which communicates those things to the customer, and they're able to sort of access it on their own terms and see all the information they need at a glance, that saves those headaches. And then sort of from there, there's the whole ops piece for the brewery of, okay, knowing what's leaving the brewery and going into the van or being picked up by couriers and hauliers on which days, and actually the invoicing. So after getting an order and delivering it, you know, that solving that headache of getting paid and making it easier for your customers to pay you.
And Julian, from a product standpoint, appreciate it's early days and you're still constantly iterating on the product, but nonetheless, clearly have some customers that are paying for this. What do customers physically get right now?
Essentially gets their own ordering platform for their customer. So it's somewhere where they get their dashboard, they can list all of their products, availabilities, it can handle different price tiers for different customers, which is you know, sort of something that's unique to breweries, like depending on what type of a customer you are to them, they'll have different price books, which makes the whole problem a little bit more complicated when you're doing things in the old way. So that's essentially it. It's a little link, you know, they can put it on their website, they can include it in their mail outs, they can include it on their social media pages, where any of their customers can, one, become a new customer super easily, but, you know, not have to fill out forms or, you know, call someone, which is how it's done today.
Just to jump in there, who are those kind of customers? Maybe a novice question for someone less familiar, but who are the typical customers of those breweries?
Sure, yeah. It's the pubs that they supply, it's the bars that they supply, it's the restaurants, you know, obviously wholesalers as well, buying directly from the breweries. But any business, you know, we see, you know, companies like Oatly on the platform, or, you know, if they're buying beer in bulk for their staff party.
Do these types of companies that you mentioned not use wholesalers rather than going direct to the brewery all the time?
Yeah, it's a good question. So they don't. They typically use a combination depending on what they're doing. But a lot of the pubs, particularly independent pubs, which is kind of a distinguishing factor or something we learned, they tend to go direct to the brewery. I would say, you know, 15%, you know, depending, give or take, is on average, is then goes to wholesalers and distributors that they work with to reach markets they couldn't, you know, support themselves. And then the last, you know, little bit is direct to consumer. And obviously, over the last few months, we've seen that change.
Do you see this having a potential consumer play? Like right now, it's early to say, and no doubt the business model will change, but could this become a B2C marketplace, or rather kind of B2B2C, or are you kind of focused right now on just nailing the kind of initial B2B business model?
Yeah, it's a great question. So it was always on the roadmap from the beginning, because, you know, when we were thinking about where this could eventually go, it was something that was on there. But it was always such a minor focus until more recently. And, you know, that sort of stems from listening to the brewery. So day one, we recognized that it was this direct trade that we wanted to solve, that 80% of the brewery's revenue that was sort of very fragmented and very challenging. So that was where we wanted to come in and focus on initially. Now, obviously, when, you know, in sort of mid-March and, you know, breweries were changing their model, we adapted and we had to work with them on getting more bottle shops signed up and more off-license type of trade customer, you know, onto the platform. And also the consumer play became much more relevant. Breweries asking us, well, given that you have all my products and my stock here, like, could we link this in? If you've got all their products there and you've got this, you're working within their workflow from receiving an order, we think that there is an opportunity to provide something differentiated for a consumer offering.
And how much do you charge a brewery, and what does revenue look like over the next 3 years, and what sort of EBITDA margin do you hope to work to?
Some fantastic questions there, Nick. So pricing is actually something that we're actively looking for support on our pricing strategy, because we're still working it out, to be honest with you. So day one, we were more focused on just trying to solve this problem. And part of that comes from making sure if you're solving a problem, they're paying you something for it, right? You know, it's a marker of value towards what you're building. So we just said, right, for the first 30 breweries, we were going to charge £200 a month, just because that was broadly in line with what they might be paying for, what they'd be paying for the types of software that they were already using. So that was the initial starting point. Although we know we're undercharging a lot of breweries, and we also know that that is limiting to some of the newer breweries. So looking at how we could potentially tier it out, look at more commission-based models as the product becomes more self-serve for the guys who are doing a little bit less volume. But yeah, that's all sort of stuff that we're looking at and will change, and we do need support with. With regards to your question, Ari, where we expect to be on sales in the next 3 years, we know that whatever number I say is going to be, you know, way off, right? It could be way more, it could be way less, or, you know, all I know for sure is it's not going to be the number that's currently on that spreadsheet, and we're still at that, you know, very early stage of it. I mean, it would actually be a great opportunity to run through the model with you, run through some of the assumptions that we have, and it could be something that we work on. Right now, to be honest, rather than, you know, focusing on where the projections are in 3 years' time, like, internally as a team, we're still very much focused on just getting to that, you know, 30 brewery mark, and then we can sort of like reassess where we're at, but it would be something to work with you on.
I'm interested to understand, and I know it's early, but what's stopping anyone else coming into this space and doing a similar thing? I know there are business models like this for other adjacencies, which you touched upon at the beginning, Julian, but I'm keen to understand essentially how you build a moat from the outset.
It's a good question. It's something we've obviously, you know, done quite a bit of thinking about. I mean, sort of as an early stage company, obviously nothing is ever stopping, you know, someone coming in and trying to do the same thing as you. I think for us, we recognized early that this is day one, just building a really sticky product. So what we've seen is like the breweries that are using Cellar become quite ingrained, and we like Cellar becomes ingrained in their sales process. And it's even more sticky than a lot of those non-customer facing products. So a lot of the breweries that we started working with, you know, actually moved away from systems that they were using before to use Cellar instead. And that is easier for them when it's sort of behind the scenes and they're upgrading, you know, their internal systems. But when it's something that all of their customers are now using, and you know, it's stickier from that perspective. So beyond that, making sure the right breweries are on there, you know, early on is something that we're focused on. So, you know, there are a number of craft breweries that are sort of held on a bit of a pedestal within the space, and they're the type of breweries that buyers would have the account on Cellar even if they didn't want to, right, to get that beer. So there's that we're looking at in the early days, but also then, you know, you have that sort of network effect. And one of the things that's unique about Cellar today is rather than it being a platform that is individual to the brewery, the buyers actually only need one account and can connect with multiple of their brewery suppliers. So if you can get that network effect going, then that's ultimately, you know, the biggest defensibility that there will be for us, I can see at this point.
Perfect. Thank you very much for that, Julian. Thoroughly enjoyed listening to the pitch and some really well-answered questions. Before Melissa and I just head off to discuss the opportunity together, could you just let us know how much you're raising at what pre-money valuation?
Yeah, so we're currently looking for 250K, and we believe that the market will determine the valuation that we're, you know, looking to raise at. So it's something that we'll work with, you know, any potential interested investors on finding something that sort of works for both parties.
Perfect. Thank you very much again for joining us today, Julian, and good luck selling into those breweries. So we're outside the pitch studio, Melissa, a chance for us two to catch up on the opportunity. I'll just throw my hat into the ring at the start. It's an interesting opportunity. Obviously, coming from Design My Night, I know the hospitality industry very well. I think it's very interesting that they left one product and immediately started to focus on what they thought was a better opportunity. I find that very admirable. And I also like the idea of using the client to help you design the product that they need. And that's something that we did a lot with our booking system at Design My Night. I would be a bit concerned personally about the size of the market. You know, do they need to get 80% of the breweries to be making good money? And I'm not sure if, you know, the revenues they have is also based on volume. We talked about SaaS subscription. I wonder if there's also a payment sort of clip where the more people ordering through the platform, the more money they make. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, so very, very much in alignment with a lot of what you said. I think Julian comes across as a really compelling individual. He seems, you know, honest. He's clearly passionate about what he's doing, but he's not afraid to talk about the unknowns and what kind of help he wants from people that he has and will bring around the table. I'm with you on the kind of market size and business model. I think both of those I left the conversation still unclear. I think it's really important, particularly for founder who's spent a lot of time researching the space, to add a lot more kind of data and quantification as to what they're doing. So the question around, you know, how do you quantify this problem? And we were kind of met with an answer that talked about, well, you know, prospective customers give us this real sense of urgency and we're replacing a massive headache. Whilst no doubt they're probably really excited, it just needs to be a bit more concrete, so that we can, as investors, get a better understanding as to how big is this problem. And therefore, even if you are to take a slice of the current market, is it worth you also thinking about a longer vision? And I think that leads on to my second point, which is I'm unclear as to what the vision of the company is, though, you know, clearly they've spent a lot of time focusing what they need in over the coming months.
Yeah, I think I agree. I think Julian comes across, you know, very well, very competent. And I suppose it's interesting, as a founder, you can get carried away in pitches in the emotion of it all, where you can talk up the game rather than actually just giving the exact figures. This is the size of the market. This is how many we think we need to get. Next year, we're hoping to launch a payment product that we're going to take a 1% fee for every transaction that goes through the account. We would hope to have a million transactions, X, Y, Z, rather than storytelling, which I think I see a lot when I meet founders, is they get lost in the story rather than, as investors, we're interested in fact.
Exactly. And to some degree, that's endearing, but I guess you have to just strike a real balance. And another point for me is around team. So, I mean, it's obviously a little bit of a different circumstance. We're not in person and it's just Julian on the call. But I would have loved to have heard a little bit more about the team. How are they splitting kind of roles and focus early on? He recognized at the beginning of the conversation, his first investors backed a team, not a concept. So I would have loved to have kind of heard, okay, well, you know exactly part of what we're waiting our decision on and what we want to learn more about. Show off your team. You know, you're clearly a very compelling individual. I'm sure you've handpicked some fantastic teammates. So I would have loved to kind of have heard more on them. But I know timing's always tight, so you can only cover so much.
What's your take on the idea of sort of solve as you go? It's a very fashionable MVP, lean startup type of way of just putting a product out there, getting customers and learning on the job and not worrying about revenues. What's your take on that?
Actually not too kind of scrutinous on hard numbers before seed, but rather what they're trying to prove out with early customers and identifying kind of very carefully who they are. So I'd be more concerned with kind of what are the milestones that they're trying to hit. And you'd like to think that, you know, as part of that journey over the course of the next 12 to 18 months, revenue in some shape or form or fantastic iterative feedback will just be a derivative of great work. So whilst we like to see traction, we've backed marketplaces who have built tens, if not hundreds of thousands of users on board, particularly in the open source community, and they'll monetize later. So I think it's more about just having a really thoughtful strategy and understanding what are the key elements of feedback that you need from your early customers to get to wherever you need to be for your next round. So less revenue sensitive, more focused on strategic goals and potentially traction as a derivative of that.
And what's your take on an open-ended valuation?
I think for first time, I mean, we don't technically lead rounds, so not really used to kind of pricing companies like this. I think it's fair enough. I think in the current circumstances, particularly, you know, a company selling to breweries, it's always interesting to understand how are they going to kind of weather the COVID storm, and does it make actual more sense to kind of give investors an expectation as to what they're expecting, because things are changing the whole time. But actually, as first-time founders who are looking for guidance and want a bunch of investors and maybe even micro VCs to come around the table, I don't think it's a bad thing to take advice from lawyers and investors to understand sort of where they should be at their current stage. I don't think that's such a bad thing at all.
Yeah, and I always find it quite refreshing also for an answer just to be, I think you said it on something else as well, just saying, actually, I'm not sure. And that's something if I bring investors on, I would want help with. I find that quite refreshing that a founder doesn't always need to give an answer, because a lot of the time it might be BS, which investors can see through.
I completely agree. I think being as upfront as Julian was, and clearly he has, you know, good open communication with the people he's currently working with, will definitely get investors on his side. So no, I really enjoyed the conversation, but have definitely left with a lot of questions.
So is it the type of opportunity at Dig you would want to hear more about and piqued your interest, or it's one that you think wouldn't be for you guys?
So when we invest really early, two things have got to come out of a couple of conversations. We have to have really, really high conviction on the team. We say, we pun intended, that we dig it. We've got to kind of absolutely love conversation and working with the founding team, and obviously that has to be mutual. And then the second piece is we want to really kind of have confidence that this team or this founder is going to have a thoughtful go-to-market strategy and have not necessarily the answer to everything, but certainly some really thoughtful different options as to what they'll take. And given I didn't really get to hear about the team on this conversation above and beyond Julian, and we didn't really get to hear any depth to how they're thinking about going to market, we sort of just scratched the surface on different business models that he might take, I'm not left with enough answers as to whether we could take this forward. So if this was a mini dig IC, we would probably no-go, though I think Julian has lots that he'd love to learn, and we have lots more to learn as investors, and so we would kind of definitely stay in touch. And I know investors always say that, but we would stay in touch and just monitor how he gets on over the next 6 to 12 months.
Yeah, and I think I'm in exactly the same boat. I think Julian clearly as a founder has something. I understand the opportunity. As an investor, I'd just like to understand if the opportunity is large enough and what seeds can grow out of that opportunity, which I didn't get that clarity on now. But again, I'd be exactly the same. I'd stay in touch. I'd want to hear progress. But as an opportunity, I get it, which I think is you know, an important part of investing. So brilliant. Thank you very much for being on Pitch Deck today. I've really enjoyed having you along. Thank you for your great insight.
Thanks, Nick.
So just a few of my final thoughts on Julian's pitch and seller. As we discussed, I think Julian comes across as a very competent founder. I think he answered questions very well. I think it's a good lesson for founders not to get carried away on the storytelling. And actually, if you have half an hour or 20 minutes in front of an investor, very systematically take them through your pitch. What's the opportunity? What are our revenue lines? Where we see the product going? Very importantly, who the team is. That's a question that always gets asked by investors. So I think that was a bit of a missed opportunity. But having said that, he's clearly a founder who could be going places. I definitely got the opportunity. There's definitely a clear pain point in the industry he's in. So all of those are tick boxes. I love the honesty of a founder to say, I don't know, or I'd like help with this. That's actually always admired by investors. And I also really like the idea of using good customers to actually help design your product. As I said, that's something that we did at Design My Night. And it just gets, you know, some really great clients loving your product if they feel like they've helped design it, especially because it means it will probably be exactly suited to what they need. And he also made one comment about trying to get some marquee accounts on board, and that gets the ball rolling. I think that's 100% true and a very smart way of looking at it. Often as a seed startup without much funding for marketing, if you can get one or two key clients and use that for PR, you'll be surprised at how quickly the ball can start rolling from there. So if you want to check out Julian's brand Seller, head over to seller.io. That's S-E-L-L-A-R. If you want to check out Dig Ventures, head over to dig.ventures. And as ever, you can head over to my startup playground at horseplay.ventures. And if you're an investor who'd be interested in speaking to Julian about Seller, drop us a line on there and we'll put you in touch. And equally, if you're a startup founder who would love to appear on a future series of Pitch Deck, please contact us there. As ever, we'd love you to share this episode and Pitch Deck itself. And as I always say, if you could just share it with one person today who you think would love it, that would be most appreciated.